You know what I hate, Dan? Traffic. I had to drive from the East Bay to Palo Alto yesterday, and normally I go around the South Bay to avoid tolls because it's only 3 minutes slower. But yesterday, I had to take the Dumbarton Toll Bridge because the traffic was so heavy. Otherwise, I would have missed my appointment. Add that to the rising cost of gas. I was paying about $2.70 a gallon a few months ago, and now I'm paying $4 a gallon.
Yeah.
Officially say, Dan, that I hate driving.
Yeah, well, I know how you feel. You know, I haven't driven recently. I got rid of my car a long time ago since I moved to San Francisco. But I have heard the same thing coming from a lot of friends. It seems like traffic is increasing around the Bay, especially over the Bay Bridge. I don't know about the Dumbarton Bridge. But I was looking at some live traffic reports recently, and it looks like traffic is back up.
Yeah, I know. I always rag on you for living in San Francisco, and we'll continue for the years to come. But what about in front of your house? Are people going back to the office?
Yeah, it has gotten noisier in front of my house. I live on a medium-sized street. It's not one of the major arteries, but I can hear a lot more traffic. Mm-hmm. I guess that's an indication of people going back to work.
Right.
And that's a good thing. At the same time, you know, the traffic noise, the high gas prices, these are problems, right?
Right.
So I was just thinking, what is being done about noisy traffic and high gas prices?
Welcome to Mobility Now, the podcast that looks at mobility technology sitting at the edge of today, but the center of tomorrow. I'm your host, Amit Mehta, head of innovation at Silicon Valley Lab.
I'm your co-host, Dan Davies, Innovation Manager at Silicon Valley Lab. We are an advanced research division of North American Lighting. It's a subsidiary of the Koito Group, the world's leading tier one supplier of exterior automotive lighting.
The first time I had the pleasure of meeting Dragos Machucha, Executive Technical Director at Ford Palo Alto, was at Stanford, where he really pinpointed the catalyst into mobility investment that drew OEMs, tier ones, and startups to work together. That was the investment into Cruise Automation of $1 billion. He's been one of the most knowledgeable and helpful people in the mobility space that I've met and has been working in automotive space in the Bay for over 20 years. How are you doing today, Dragos?
Doing okay. How are you?
Good. Doing well.
It's really great to have you here, Dragos. I wanted to start...
Pleasure is all mine.
Great. I wanted to start a little bit about you. Can you tell us about your journey and how you got where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is almost a full circle. So I came to California for grad school at Berkeley back in 92.
Go Bears.
It's been a while, unfortunately. And I did my PhD thesis of all things in automated vehicles. So at that time, it wasn't autonomous vehicles. We didn't have the kind of compute power that we have today. We didn't have the kind of developments in machine learning we have today. But it was about intelligent vehicles and highway systems. And some of your audience may remember IVHS in the US, Project Prometheus in Europe. So it does this concept of the interaction between vehicles and the highway, which, you know, nowadays we call V2I and V2V and V2X. But it was a lot more reliant on the infrastructure, more classic controls. And then I ended up working for BMW when car companies were just coming to Silicon Valley. You have to give another credit to another competitor, Mercedes. They came in 97, then BMW came in 99. And then there were, you know, a handful of companies around here. And frankly, for a long time, I knew pretty much everyone in this space because that intersection between Silicon Valley and the automotive industry was relatively small. My personal journey then took me around to the semiconductor industry. I worked for KLA Tencor for a while, and then defense. Worked for Lockheed Martin Space Systems, working on satellites here in Palo Alto. Then I worked for Apple for a few years in Cupertino, and then when Ford opened this office about 6 years ago, I came back to the automotive industry, back to automated and autonomous vehicles, back to running a satellite office of a car company in Silicon Valley. And we all know what happened in the last 5-6 years, where that intersection between Silicon Valley and the automotive industry has increased dramatically. And now I can't honestly say that I know everyone at that intersection, because we went from a handful of people to thousands of people that work in that intersection.
Right, great. So I'm really excited about your new Mustang Mach-E, and it's your first mass market electric car. Deliveries have already started. How has the consumer response been?
It has been absolutely amazing. I just got deliveries of one about a week ago. And what's fascinating to me is the kind of people that give you a thumbs up. It's a completely new demographic. I mean, by the numbers, we have some 70% of the pre-orders came in from people who are brand new to the brand, brand new to Ford. A lot of them from the coasts. But what's fascinating to me at an anecdotal level is to see people in Teslas giving you thumbs up at a stoplight. I've seen people in Mercedes is stopping me on the sidewalk asking me about a car. My neighbor across the street who works in tech and has a Porsche and Tesla, he hasn't talked cars with me for the 6 years that we've been here. But he came in immediately when he saw the Mach-E in the garage. He came in immediately to talk about cars. So it's really a fascinating environment, what's happening, and the kind of demand that we're having for electric vehicles. And when you put a really good product out there, it shows. You know, people are definitely interested.
Yeah. Can you tell me about some of the new features?
Yeah, so we have phone as a key, so you can access your vehicle through your phone and enter and start it. Cool. Another feature on top of that, we have sort of backup on backup. So if that doesn't work, you can still access your vehicle through a keypad on the door and the password inside the vehicle. So we provided a lot of access points that do not rely on the usual key fab. It's also one of the first vehicles that we're going to have a high level of autonomy later in the year. And that the reason I'm saying later in the year is that the hardware is already there, and we're going to start doing over the air updates again. The kind of penetration that you have in terms of software and doing updates, it's a new space for a legacy OEM, and the software impact is starting to show in the products that we're putting now on the market.
That is really cool and fascinating that you're getting a lot of consumers from the coasts. We don't see a whole lot of F-150s here in the Bay right now, but maybe we'll start seeing more of the Mach-E's.
Exactly.
So really cool about the technology. Some really interesting features there. Was that technology developed in-house, or are you working with collaboration partners to develop that?
For a lot of the technologies, we're doing both. So it's interaction between partners from the usual supply chain, but in recent years, more a lot from startups, but also building the knowledge in-house. So a lot of the technologies that we're developing is a mix between outside technologies and developed in-house. So it's basically the model of open innovation, looking for innovation that comes in from a variety of areas. So we're not just restricted to the traditional supply chain or just internal.
Right. That's great. And I know you're collaborating with a lot of startups as well. That's part of the part of one of the missions that Ford has with its presence here in the Bay. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Can you tell me a little bit about how you interact with startups, and specifically, how do you decide which ones you want to work with? Maybe could you point out three criteria or so that you use to decide?
Yeah, certainly. So the initial approach to the startups, it's it's a push-pull. So it could be either that we know already what the headquarters is looking for in terms of direction, what areas we need to fill in, where we may have gaps, what are the areas that startups could fill. And we look through the ecosystem in the Valley, where I think we're very good partners in this ecosystem. We've done a lot of pay it forward. Mm-hmm. And so we can call on a lot of our partners to help us fill in those gaps. Mm. The other way is a push where we find some interesting technology, again, through the network here, through the ecosystem, that we realize that particular technology can be inserted in vehicles. And it doesn't have to be developed initially specifically for vehicles. We have enough technologies and enough imagination where we can bring in technologies developed for other spaces, and we adapt it and adopt it into the automotive industry. So it's a push-pull and constant collaboration with our colleagues back in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Once we have that initial interaction, we need to evaluate it versus what we could do internally. So we're looking at technologies that, you know, are they really bringing something unique? Do they have a strategic differentiator? Is there something in there that we wouldn't normally do in our routine development of technology? And then we look at the team. The team a lot of times is absolutely the most essential factor, because
right.
a coachable team, a team that understands how we work, that understands how we can collaborate, can make a huge difference. A team that can pivot, that is coachable, is fantastic. And even if the initial technology is not perfect, we can work with them to guide them into a product that we can find useful later in integrate into our products. The opposite is true too. We've met teams that have great technology. We would love to use it, but the teams are so hard to work with, so uncoachable, so that honestly, you need to give up on that, because this is a marriage, right? You're not going in for a transactional relationship where you just buy something once and you move on. Mm-hmm. It's a sweat and tears and effort on both sides, and you need to work together. And if we don't have that coachability, that relationship over the long term, you're not going to end up with a good product. We have passed on possible teams because we found them to be uncoachable. And then last, once we find a technology that is good, once we like the team, we find it strategic, typically we increase the level of collaboration, I would say almost exponentially. So we have gateways where the level of interaction almost doubles every single time. We can cut it off at any point if we think that it doesn't make sense anymore. But if we continue, typically it's not a linear engagement. Typically it's an exponential engagement in terms of both effort and financial reward in terms of NREs. Mm-hmm. Once we reach a decently high level of engagement, at that point, we have a bunch of decisions to make. Either we start using the product, the startup's product into our product, so it starts to have a clear path to production. At that point in time, we may decide to also invest, take equity in the company. We might even invest or decide on an acquisition. So there are a bunch of decision points that we make once the engagement has reached a certain maturity level that we find that beyond that, we need to have a really strong engagement to continue.
Great, thank you. That was summarized it quite well for anybody listening out there. I'm gonna switch topics a little bit, because I think this is a lot of interest to the public, but there have been a lot of SPACs recently, specifically mobility. You have these zero revenue companies with basically heavy CapEx raising money into what may be considered a bubble. If you were a VC, would you support this activity or look for the startup to become a little more developed in their market and technology?
Yeah, definitely 2020 has been the year of SPAC, and especially in mobility. I think if I counted correctly, there have been about 23 SPACs in mobility, six in LiDAR. Absolutely, it has been a banner year for SPACs in mobility. And is it a bubble? I think history will decide that. You know, personal opinion is that yes, it is. And I don't think the market can support six LiDAR companies. Never mind that we're tracking some 100 of them. But that's to some extent the beauty of the valley. It's this constant growth. And then you have this sort of forest fire that cleans up, and then you have growth again in the wake of that. Mm-hmm. And frankly, some of the most amazing startups and companies were founded during some of these downturns or following a bubble popping. So from their point of view, from the startup's point of view, they realize that they need a lot of CapEx. So they have to follow this path. From a VC, I know that a lot of the later rounds from the VCs, from what I hear from them, is that they have been pushed out because of SPACs. So to some extent, you don't even have a choice because you are being pushed out in favor of a SPAC. Hmm. But even if that wasn't the case, I would still argue, especially for corporate VCs, that the early stage is much more beneficial because this is where you can influence the product. That's where we can influence the team. That's where you have that advantage versus others, because by the time it gets that late in the process, pretty much anyone in the space would know about this technology. What I find useful and strategic is to find technologies early on where you can have a differentiator versus your competitors, where you can detect trends earlier than others. By the time someone reaches a SPAC, I think the trend is pretty clear. I think pretty much all the competitors know about the technology. Yeah. So it becomes a completely different discussion than the early stages when it can influence the technology.
Yeah.
Now, on the exit side, clearly investors need to be careful with SPACs. A lot of them seem to pop quite a bit after the reverse merger, and then they retreat back to the original $10, $11 a share. I'm not a financial advisor, so that's not my place to advise people where to invest their money, but I would definitely say be careful.
Fascinating. Yeah, great. It makes a lot of sense. The early stage startups seem to fit into the strategy that you talked about earlier with the flexibility in the team and being able to have an effective marriage with Ford. So what are some of the early stage startups and technology fields that you're looking at now that you think maybe will hit the markets in 5 to 7 years?
Yeah, so I need to stay obviously generic about this because we don't talk about specifics. But again, as I mentioned earlier, I think what's important about being part of this ecosystem and making investments in startups is that you start seeing trends early on. You start seeing tiny signals that then get amplified over the years and through the discussions that you have. So, you know, one of these trends is all these AI chips that are trying to make silicon dedicated to machine learning. If you look back 5-6 years ago, there was only NVIDIA with GPUs in this space. And NVIDIA got into this space because of the investments they were making in the ecosystem. And they realized that people in the machine learning space were using GPUs to process the neural networks because the math for graphics happens to be the same math that you have for neural networks, which is the multiply and adds. The one disadvantage of the GPUs is they were meant for graphics. That's what the G is for. So now you're starting to see, maybe about 5 years ago, we started seeing two or three companies that were starting to take on, they were trying to take on NVIDIA. And it was fascinating at the time that Silicon Valley was finally investing again in silicon, because, you know, for about a decade, most of the investments were done in software. And, right. you know, silicon requires obviously a lot of capital. And it was fascinating to see that. And you start seeing two or three companies, all of a sudden that becomes a trend. Now we're tracking over 75 startups that are trying to make chips dedicated to machine learning. And because there are so many of them, you're now starting to split even those in various groups, where there are some that are meant for inference, others are meant for training. If you look at the underlying technology, some are going in the digital space, some in the analog, some are in the silicon photonics. Some are addressing the memory transfer of the data from, you know, from memory to the compute stage. So it's fascinating to see the various approaches that people are having in order to make these chips more efficient. And it's critical for both in-vehicle use and for servers that we're starting to use less power. For vehicle, obviously that translates directly into range. For the cloud compute, it translates directly into climate change, because the server farms are using an enormous amount of energy. So it will be interesting, just like the LiDAR space, that now we're tracking some 100 companies. It'll be interesting to see how that sorts out, mm-hmm. and who are going to be the few winners out of this. It'll be interesting to see how this space will settle in the next few years.
Great.
And then the other couple of trends, I would say, is one is in the camera space, driven mostly by consumer electronics, by consumer devices. You have cameras getting cheaper and better. And we went from having one camera per vehicle for the backup camera to now having at least four on the outside and a couple on the inside. And autonomous vehicles are having up to a dozen of them. So clearly a huge amount of use of cameras both in and outside the vehicle. And then the last one that seems interesting to me is this fusion between a variety of sensors. So a fusion between cameras and LiDAR, generating a different device it looks at the visual space. Fusion between LiDAR and radar, looking at different frequencies, but in FMCW modality. Adding these AI chips that I mentioned earlier right behind the cameras and having an imager with intelligence built in. Those are trends that are starting to form now. And again, it would be interesting to see how they evolve over the next few years.
Yeah, very interesting. So you mentioned some interesting things here. We're seeing some increase in the performance and the number of cameras. Same thing with LiDAR. And then we're needing more processing power to not only sort through that vast amount of data that they're collecting, but also fuse them together. So you have multiple modes of sensing that are being brought together. That requires computing power as well. At the same time as electric vehicles start to become more prominent, we have a more limited power budget. So there's this trade-off between more processing power, better sensors, but also the constraint that they have to be low power. How do you think this is going to shape the automotive industry going forward in the long term, say out to 2050?
You know, I get asked that question quite a bit. And I honestly don't know. The simple answer is I don't know what this industry will look at in 2050. But look, when we're going to look back from 2050 to today, I'm sure we're going to agree that this was a decade of inflection. There are an enormous amount of changes that are happening in the automotive industry and in transportation in general. From the shift to electric vehicles, the shift to autonomy, urban air mobility, there's a whole new space of changes that's happening in the automotive industry. The other interesting thing is all these autonomy that we're developing for vehicles is starting to percolate in other industries too. So it's moving from robotaxis to trucking. It's moving from robotaxis to last mile delivery vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
It's moving off-road into construction, mining, agriculture. There are dozens of startups that are trying to address all these other spaces in autonomy. And it's fascinating how those industries will change as the autonomy is percolating from one industry to another.
Cool. Wow, that's really good information, especially I like your point about the decade of inflection, because I think you're totally right. We're here now and we're seeing this incredible investment in mobility and we're seeing everything grow. With that being said, I have an interesting question for you, Dragos. What has surprised you the most in the last 10 years in the space of mobility?
I think the speed of this inflection. So honestly, I joined Ford 6 years ago because I felt that a change was coming to the automotive industry. And I wanted to be part of that change and help shape the change. But to be honest, even I didn't realize how fast this change will be. The advances in machine learning that have happened over the last 5 years, the reduction in the cost of electric powertrains, the governments throughout the world, one after another, talking about banning internal combustion engines starting in the 2030, 2040 timeframe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a form of acceleration coming in from COVID, where cities are starting to be reshaped, where you have major arteries being banned to cars and open to restaurants. So the cities themselves, I think, will change and adapt to a world of autonomy and electrification, again, to an extent that we're just starting to understand. And I think until about 5 years ago, we were sort of on that linear area of any exponential curve where we think everything is going to keep going linear. And I think we're starting to enter that knee of the exponential curve right now where things are only going to accelerate from here on.
Oh, great. Thank you. I really appreciate you being here today, Dragos. It was quite beneficial to us, to our audience. I think there's a lot of information here. Before you go, I just want to ask, do you have any advice for new grads coming into the mobility space, specifically those that want to get into the technology investor space?
Yeah, it's interesting for me to talk about this, because what got me in the automotive industry was that passion for driving, the feel of the steering and the suspension and the noise of a V12.
Right,
you know, and that's not what I would advise current graduates. I would advise them to get into, you know, machine learning and AI. And even if they are in tangential fields, even if they are not the ones programming the neural networks, they should at least understand the capability of this technology and how to use it, how to leverage it. Even if you are in finance, you need to understand that the impact that this technology is having, because it will be absolutely fundamental. And then the other thing I would say it's broadness and stay a student throughout your career. Learn continuously, because changes are only accelerating. So we're talking about, you know, the derivative of the derivative. So the changes themselves are accelerating. And you need to stay on top of it, because otherwise you're going to be left behind. So you need to have that flexibility in where you are going to go, because you're going to have to change directions often. And you need to be constantly curious, because you need to learn on a continuous basis. You can't just graduate and expect to use that knowledge for the rest of your career anymore.
Thank you, Dragos. That was actually really good, very well spoken. And I think it brings a lot of information to our audience, to new grads. I really like the part where you said that, you know, you're not going into school anymore and doing a master's on NVH like you were 20 years ago. You're doing it on AI, and it's still connected with mobility. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. I had a lot of fun.
Great. Thanks again. And please join us next time on Mobility Now, where our next guest will be Saeed Amidi, CEO of Plug and Play. Thanks. Take care.